following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.
Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by Just Foods. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring people back to what's great in food. Culinary traditions, cooking at home, knowing your farmer, or even growing your own food. I spotlight good food fighters and the culture of the good food movement. From chefs to tastemakers to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking fried chicken and our Type and Tell segment. If you're listening live to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network, ring us. Our number here is 718-497-2128. Keep it spicy, a must-do on our food radio show. In the studio to talk Yardbird, Up South Food, and the restaurant business is Craig Samuels, one half of three of BK's finest food spots. Craig, welcome to Hot Grease.
Well, thank you.
Glad to have you on. So let's get right to it. Please tell us, what is good fried chicken?
Well, it's crispy. It's okay. Juicy. I like my chicken hot, and I like it spicy, well seasoned, and plentiful.
So, what are some of the mistakes when people are either making fried chicken at home, or you go out to a spot and you're like, not so much? What are some of the common mistakes?
I don't know. There are a lot of ways to mess up fried chicken. And, you know, I would say that everybody who starts, the first time you make fried chicken, you fry it with the temperature too high. Everybody's done that. Mm-hmm. Where the outside is dark brown, the inside is still raw. And that right there is about as bad as it gets. Not seasoning your chicken with enough time for the seasoning to get in.
Man, that is the worst. I've had that so many times in Brooklyn, the poorly seasoned chicken. I don't know. You just can't combat that.
If the breading or the crust falls off, that's a no-no. Well, I mean, I don't want to talk about bad fried chicken.
What good fried chicken.
Yeah.
You just told us. So it's the seasoning. It's the outside. It's
nice and crisp.
Tenderness.
Nice and juicy.
So what do you think people need to really, if someone is having fried chicken for the first time, do they need a thigh or they need a breast?
I personally like thighs. My wife prefers, you know, the breasts and the wings. But I think that a perfectly cooked thigh is about as good as it gets.
Yeah, when I come to a Peach's Hot House, I definitely get the white meat. I think it's not dry, though.
Well, you know, our breasts aren't dry. A lot of people just throw all of it in together. We cook the breasts and the thighs separately. Uh-huh. So they each cook for their right amount of time, and they come out extra juicy.
So Nashville style chicken at Peach's Hot House. Mm-hmm. If I went to some of my Tennessee natives or Tennessee friends, would they understand this term Nashville style chicken?
Well, I'm going to say we coined the phrase Nashville style, but we didn't create the style of chicken.
Gotcha.
The style of chicken came from a place in Nashville called Prince's Hot Chicken Shack. and it's been around for, I mean, I think something like 50 years now. And it's what the chicken is this incredibly spicy, crispy, juicy chicken cooked by the same family since day one. And because it is such a very specific regional dish, and right now I think in Nashville there may be 5 people who do it, and there may be 5 people outside of Nashville who do it, including us. It's not as common as one might think.
So if I have a hard time describing to people when they come to Bedford-Stuyvesant or they hear I live there and I talk about Peach's Hot House, I was like, you just have to taste it. What words, how can I describe the flavor of the net, except for saying, you know, you can get the very hot, the hot. How should I be describing this to folks?
The chicken itself or Peach's Hot House?
No, the chicken itself, the Nashville style.
Well, what we do with the Nashville style, and the truth is, I mean, in Tennessee, there are two schools of thought. There's the Memphis style, which I also love. You get that at Gus's in Memphis.
Yeah.
I've been to Gus's plenty of times.
I've had that, yeah.
It's single dipped. It's incredibly salty, very, very well seasoned. Nashville style is a double dip, so it's really, really crunchy on the exterior. Very heavy crust, but to repeat myself, it is well seasoned. You know, yes. our regular chicken is not regular by any stretch of the imagination. It is a little extra spicy. We cook all of our chicken to order, so I mean, you come prepared to wait. There's nothing sitting under a heat lamp. But it's extremely crunchy, extremely well seasoned, very juicy. Everything that I said that I think fried chicken should be.
So you have the mild, the hot, the very hot. I cannot eat the very hot. Can you eat it, Craig?
I eat one piece every week without fail.
Very hot? Oh my gosh, folks. The very hot, I cannot take it.
I make everybody who works there eat a piece every couple of weeks, and I say you have to practice what you preach.
So how many people come in? I usually get the hot or the mild. The chicken is absolutely delicious. No joke, folks. But the very hot, I feel like you have to have a strong gut for the hot.
I'll tell you. Our extra hot is a prince's hot.
What?
His extra hot just burns right through the plate, right through the table, onto the floor. I mean, it is so spicy that I was afraid that we would be sued. This is New York City. I mean, you get sued for anything. But the extra hot is exactly as you put it. You take a bite, you start to sweat. I mean, it is a very specific thing.
Still very flavorful, but I mean, you have to concentrate on that when you're eating that. It's really good. So this past weekend, I visited Tipsy Parsons, which is a Southern comfort food spot in Manhattan, and the food was great. What are some of your favorite spots, either in New York City or outside, that nail this new Southern comfort food?
You know, nail this new Southern comfort food? That's a good way to put it. I'll be honest with you. I like a couple of places in Williamsburg. Only because they're easy, they're comfortable. I know the people who work there, and you know, I stroll in, get what I need, stroll out, and I got my fix. One of them, we had a discussion about back. One of them is Egg.
Oh, Egg is my favorite spot. I was just there last week.
I see George in the back every time I walk in. I come in early in the morning because you got to get there before the people start writing their name down. But I come early in the morning. Get my food, get my fix. I love their biscuits. I love their eggs. Just
their chicken is good too. I was there last Friday, and their specials.
I've never had their chicken.
Oh wow, their chicken is good.
I only go for breakfast. It is my breakfast spot. Period. And another place that I go, and I go because again, it's quick, it's easy. You know, I know them. I always feel comfortable there.
Yeah,
is Pies and Thighs.
Oh. I'm just gonna say I've talked about Pies and Thighs on the show. I mean, I love your business owners. I love your Pies and Thighs. But their chicken is frozen and it's not seasoned well. But hey, maybe it's the support, the atmosphere. The service is great.
I'll tell you, their pies are great. I mean, they're chocolate.
Everyone to keep telling.
I've had their chocolate pudding and their key lime. And I'm thinking about it right now. I'm probably going to pick one up on the way back to the restaurant.
I have not. Honestly, I didn't try the pie there. I tried the chicken. So
the name
I'm gonna
is
go
Pies
back.
And Thighs.
Yeah, that's a fail. That's a fail. I'm going to go back.
All right. We'll go together.
So speaking of people going to spots, you know, because of the service, that's what you just said. Why do you think people return time and time again to Smoke Joint, Peaches, and Peaches Hot House? Is it the memories, the food? Is it the down home feel? Because the bartender at Peaches, I do not know his name. Dark skinned guy.
Bald head.
Yes.
That guy has kept my lights on.
His name
is Ron.
Yes.
And I know I'm going to lose Ron one day. He's looking to open his own place. And I'm behind him. I want it to happen. But I know the day he leaves, I've got to start working extra hard again.
But I'm telling you, Ron is Peaches.
Ron sees you coming. Ron
yes,
sees you coming.
I love him. So why do people come to Peaches and Peaches Hot House time and time again?
Ron sees you coming. I mean, I would hope that people are coming for the food, for the service. I think that we are fair. I mean, I think that our prices are gentle. I think that, I mean, we definitely are ensconced in each community that we're in. I mean, you know, one in Fort Greene, one in Stuyvesant Heights, one in the heart of Bed-Stuy. I mean, we know our customers. I know half of my customers by name. And,
you
know,
I come know, in I there know, too much, huh? Well,
but, I mean, when you go there, don't you feel as though Alicia always recognizes you?
Yeah, I called the other day on the phone. And
we know your voices as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So
y'all come back now, you hear?
So this is a question I've never, in doing all of my research, is that really a Peaches? Is that someone?
Peaches is my wife's grandmother.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Peaches. If you look in both Peaches, there's a picture of up on the wall.
Okay, I've never paid attention to that.
I used to have her right over the bar. Because she didn't drink, but I liked the way she was kind of looking to the side, and it was kind of like, you know, the way she was looking at all the bar patrons. I would say she's watching you. You know,
oh, wow. Careful. Love that. Love that. So we're going to take a short break, folks. If you are tuned in, stay put. We're going to come back with more Craig.
Ready for action, nipping in the bud, we never relaxing. Outcast is everlasting, not clashing, not at all. But see, my went to do a little acting. Now that's for anyone asking. Give me one, pass them. Drip, drip, drop, there goes an orgasm. Now you coming out the side of your face, be tapping right into your memory bank. Saints, so click the ticket, let's see your seatbelt fasten. Trunk rattling, like 2 minutes in the back seat wrestling. Speaker box vibrate the tag, make it sound like aluminum cans in a bag. But I know y'all wanted that 808, can you feel that BASS, babe? But I know y'all wanted that 808, can you feel that BASS? All I do
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.com. We're chatting the reimagined Meat and Three with Craig Samuels. Craig owns a New York style barbecue joint in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, Peaches and Peaches Hot House in Bedford Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. Speaking of Meat and Three, First Lady Michelle Obama unveiled the USDA's My Plate icon last week, which replaces the pyramid, I think most people know. Do you think this new chart will help folks order or prepare more fruits and vegetables?
You know, I think people who want fruits and vegetables will get them, chart or no. It would be nice if this would help people to start thinking about their food in a new way. You know, I've heard a lot of criticism about the food pyramid and, you know, how to use it, and people were, you know, confused. And confusion or no, my mother didn't have a pyramid. She didn't have the plate chart. I mean, I can't even, there was something before the pyramid.
Yeah, it was. I can't remember what it was.
I can't remember what it was. But the point was, she always made sure that, you know, our plate made sense nutritionally, and the food is always delicious. So if we could find a way to present food that is delicious, nutritious, and affordable, and that last part is one of the things that I think most people have a hard time with, you know, and this plate could help. Great.
So let's talk social responsibility in restaurants owners. You're very responsible. I know for a fact that you purchase stuff for the Bed-Stuy Farm Share or CSA. Correct me if I'm wrong. You use Freebird.
We use Freebird, yes.
At Peach's Hot House. Are you ever annoyed when people bug you about the source of food?
You know, I've been in this field for 22 years. And, you know, 15 years ago, we didn't have the same movement that we have now.
Uh-huh.
So people didn't think of it in the same way. I came up in French restaurants. I spent 15 years working at white tablecloth French restaurants
were the worst back in the day.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know what you mean by worst, but you know,
getting stuff from like way across the water.
Okay. I'm going to agree with that. You know, I worked in France in 2000, and there was not a restaurant in Paris that didn't serve Maine lobster. Not one. So that's also something to think about. You know, I will say this. We try to be responsible. I am not a tree hugger. You know, I do have... We had a discussion
tree hugger
about this.
What does that mean, Craig? You're stereotyping folks.
I'm not stereotyping anyone. I think that everybody's got their path.
True.
And my path is one where responsibility to me means... You know, preparing food in a ideally a healthy and wholesome way. We're talking about fried chicken here.
Yeah, you know? We are talking about fried chicken. But I've been a fan of Hot House from the very beginning. I mean, you have fried chicken, but you also do vegetables.
Well, all of our restaurants, we make sure that there's at least a quarter of the items are vegetarian. So a lot of people at the beginning were like, oh, I can't eat at your restaurant because I'm a vegetarian. And I would show them that fully 25% of our menu was vegetarian. And, you know, it wasn't just salads. I mean, we had collard greens and we had, you know, mac and cheese. Of course, again, we're still talking about some heavy things. But once we opened Peaches, I wanted to open a different type of Southern restaurant. I wanted it, and we referred to it as contemporary Southern. But what we wanted to show was that it's actually, in my opinion, more traditional than what you think of as a traditional Southern or soul food restaurant, because with, you know, America's agrarian past, you know, the fact that the places that we're honoring were the breadbasket of America, and the people who ate there weren't always the wealthiest. Meat was not the center of the plate. I mean, we were eating all sorts of vegetables. It's uncommon, you know, to think that 50 years ago we were eating primarily fruits and vegetables directly.
Yeah.
I mean, before Bird's Eye stepped in and messed everything up, you know, that's what we ate.
So I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm hearing you strive for a balance as a business owner and also as a person who understands there are a chunk of people out there like myself who come into your restaurant and always question you where your stuff is coming from. I mean, I think your prices are not like $18 or $20. You're keeping it affordable. So what I'm hearing is that you are striking a balance.
Well, you know, it's a lot easier to strike a balance at Hot House, for example, because Hot House is 25 seats. And, you know, we're able to source 70 to 80% of our stuff at Hot House from farms and locally. At Peaches, it's not that easy.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say at Peaches, it's closer to 50 or 60% that we're able to get, you know, locally. And then there's also, you know, customer tastes. You know, my primary objective is to stay open. You know, so if my customer wants asparagus in November, and I'm looking at you funny because we had this conversation a year ago.
What? Asparagus in November? But I get it. I'm not opposed because I feel like if someone is trying to make a healthy choice, just like we're talking about the food pyramid, and they were like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go to Peaches. I'm going to get a veggie plate, and I'm going to get asparagus. I'm not going to knock it. I would prefer not to eat.
Well, I would say that, you know, once, and again, I said 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. 5 years ago, when all of this really started to hit a stride and things were more available, you know, you weren't eating only turnips and rutabaga in December. And that's not how people eat. I mean, if my menu in Bed-Stuy were all turnips, rutabaga, kale, and cauliflower, I mean, it just wouldn't work. I mean, don't get me wrong.
No, I agree. I don't want that outside me either. I'm going to keep it real.
But, you know, what I do pride myself on with the asparagus is that I brought asparagus to restaurants in Bed-Stuy.
Hey, I'm not knocking it. I love it. So I have to ask you, anything new? I keep hearing rumors, positive rumors, mm-hmm. not bad rumors, that you are expanding. Anything new that you can talk about and share with the folks that are listening to Hot Grease?
Well, currently on the Lewis Avenue Strip, right down the street from Peaches, we just opened a small catering space. I think you came to an event we did there. Right next to that catering space, we're in the throes of trying to complete the space and finish what's going to be a really interesting food service concept. And I'm not going to go any deeper
than that. So that's the space that you're talking about, people who are listening, that's the old bread side?
No. Oh. No, that's actually where Lewis Gallery was.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so can I tell you what I want?
Yes.
I've already talked to Patrick, if you guys are listening. Patrick Martins. He and I came to Hot House. I was like, we need a cheese spot. We need a bread spot. Mm-hmm. You should get mm-hmm. Ann to Ann Saxelby as his fiance to open something.
Oh, really? I had no idea.
Yeah. So I hope you bring some meat because I'm tired. I love Green Grape Provisions. Mm-hmm. Shout out. She's been on the show before. But I want to go down that way and pick up some stuff. So I'm just throwing that out there to you. So if you want to, you know, huddle, and we can brainstorm about products there. Just let me know when. So, folks, if you want to check out Peaches Hot House Smoke Joint, give us the deets in terms of websites and locations.
Okay, I will, and I'll do it very quickly.
Yes.
Peaches is peachesbrooklyn.com. Peaches Hot House is peacheshothouse.com. And the Smoke Joint is thesmokejoint.com.
Cool. So if you're listening to Hot Grease now and you're visiting New York, it's worth a trip to visit any of those spots. And if you're in New York City and you keep hearing everybody talking about Hot House, you need to get over there. They're open for dinner service at...
Hot House is 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. 4 right. o'clock every
Weekends,
day.
Weekends, it's 11 o'clock in the morning.
And the brunch is good. The grits are good. Great, yes. Yeah. Craig, thank you so much for joining us on Hot Grease. You know I'll be talking about you in the coming months. We're going to take a short break and keep listening. We'll be back with Type and Tell.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I am your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced and engineered by Jack Inslee. This program is being sponsored by Just Foods. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York, the location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. Remember Show and Tell in grade school? Here on High Grease, we have the grown-up version, Type and Tell. In this segment, we shout out the latest national or local discovery. In the studio, we have Tyler Caruso and Eric Factoy.
Thanks for having us.
They have 5 days left in their Seeing Green, the Value of Urban Farms Kickstarter.com project. Again, welcome. I'm glad to spread the good news.
Thanks so much, Nicole. We really appreciate it.
So give us a deet so we can tell the world about the project.
So Tyler and myself, Eric,
We originally started off going to school together at Pratt Institute and working a little bit with environmental planning, and we both very interested in local food movements and the urban farm especially, and we developed an idea of beginning to try to think about how the environmental benefits outside of just food that these urban farms provide, and we wanted to look at stormwater capture specifically.
Yeah, Eric, when I became friends, I think he was maybe avoiding me a little bit, so I tracked him down, and then we decided to work together on our thesis and do a research project.
So both of you guys were working on stormwater issues with your... Oh, wow. So this kind of was like a organic type thing. Love it.
Yeah, I think we both needed a little bit of direction, and we have different strengths, and so we started talking about urban agriculture and really this term that you hear a lot about, green infrastructure.
Yeah.
And something that made sense was that community gardens and urban farms are part of green infrastructure, but it's not part of the conversation. And I think there's a lot of expertism that goes on around these terms. And all of the farmers and gardeners have been the backbone of this. They've been, and these gardens and communities and farms are serving the cities, and they're not getting credit, and they've been struggling for so long.
So what made you guys decide Kickstarter.com? For people who are listening, we talked about Kickstarter here on the show before. I mean, it's a great way to jump off a project or an idea someone is doing. So when did you get the bright bulb and said, Kickstarter?
Well, we finished up our thesis, which was developing the methodology for our project. And we were thinking, well, how can we start off running? How can we hit the ground, really get funding, and really spread the word quickly? And speaking to friends of ours that have had successful Kickstarter campaigns, we figured this was the perfect opportunity.
And I think it's great because it's also, we've gotten so much help. So we like that this project would be owned by everyone that could back it and understand it and kind of pass the word on. And I think that was a big reason for us about Kickstarter. It's us asking for help and connecting it to people.
So speaking of passing the word on, so folks are listening now, I'm listening, and I want to tell people, yeah, Tyler and Eric are doing this project on Kickstarter.com. You need to donate so they can make this a reality. What would I tell folks in like 140 characters or less? I'm being funny. I'm using the Twitter thing. How should I explain this to folks?
I think in order to support urban agriculture from a city or policymaker's perspective, which is what we're trying to do, cities need numbers and metrics.
Uh-huh.
And so what we're looking to do is one small part of that, which is stormwater. So we understand that stormwater, once it hits open space, either infiltrates and it's permanently taken up and then evaporated out, or it's held for a period of time. And we wanted to know how much these farms and community gardens are actually doing. So we're trying to develop the number of, you have a farm, Brooklyn Grange.
Gotcha.
How many gallons is this farm taking out of our sewer systems and helping to alleviate combined sewage overflows?
Speaking of Brooklyn Grange, Eric, so on your Kickstarter page, if you go to Kickstarter, it's the Seeing Green Project. You guys have this great video. You're at Brooklyn Grange, right? And I also see you guys in the lab. Are you a biologist?
Yes, I am. As an undergrad, I studied biology. And so a lot of the experiments that we're going to have to run work with like hard science. And so we have access to a lab, as well as the whole point of the Kickstarter is to get the equipment that is necessary to actually do this research. And we're planning on making all of the knowledge public when we're finally done, so this can be replicated not only in New York but in other cities across the country.
Yeah, that's the word in reading your bio or description of the Kickstarter, and even in the video, Ben Flanner, you guys know Ben Flanner from Roberta's and Brooklyn Grange, I hear the word replication. That word is really big for me. Can you talk a little bit about the whole, what this means to people who are listening, who may be in Georgia, who may be in the Midwest or on the West Coast, the work that you could possibly do if you're funded through Kickstarter?
I think, well, what Eric and I are trying to do is we're trying to create a method to look at how much stormwater is being managed on these urban farms, and urban farms, wherever they are, you know, manage stormwater. And so what we want to do is help other people set up this research and create these metrics to be able to talk to policymakers, decision makers, help convince developers why this is not only a smart idea, but a socially responsible idea. And numbers are the best way to do that.
So if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, people are donating to something that is new and groundbreaking. There's no one else doing this, right?
Yeah.
To the best of our knowledge.
Oh, we have a caller on the phone. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Good afternoon. This is Melissa Danielle calling.
Melissa, a regular here on Hot Grease. Your question, Melissa.
I'm just curious if this project is only looking at the role stormwater can play in implementation of urban farms, because there are a lot of people in New York City, for example, who maintain backyard gardens and kitchen gardens, and a lot of them do collect stormwater to water their gardens. I actually have a rain barrel that was given to me free by DEP 2 years ago. They have had two or three cycles of a free rain barrel giveaway in New York City, in Brooklyn and Queens mostly.
Thank
so
you for your question.
Curious.
Thank you for your question, Melissa.
I think that's a great question. We're just looking to start someplace. So what we're trying to do is to keep it really small so it can be replicated. But ideally, the idea is to get metrics to start to develop. Mara Gittleman, who's a friend of both Nicole's and ours, does Farming Concrete. And that's a similar idea, is how do you start to look at all of the different outputs of these farms or gardens on a personal scale, whether it's a community garden, a rooftop farm, it doesn't really matter. We're all contributing towards making our cities more sustainable and a better place. And we would love to be able to, you know, start working at looking at rainwater harvesting, start looking at container gardens, and developing this template or this methodology.
So, folks, if you're listening, I say get on the bandwagon early. Type and tell people about the Seeing Green project. If folks wanted to go directly to your Kickstarter, is there, I didn't see the exact address of the Kickstarter /
It's / Seeing Green.
Oh,
value
cool.
Of urban farms. You can also just search it in there. If you search Seeing Green, it'll come up. And we also have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/supportingurbanag.
Okay, cool.
And our username is Stormwater Masters.
Oh, I love that. Stormwater Master. So I'm going to retweet. There are a few people already on Twitter who've retweeted your video and your Kickstarter. There are 5 more days left. You guys are raising how much?
$12,000 for equipment only.
$12,000 for equipment only. And you are probably, how much you need?
$8,000.
Oh, it's possible. I mean, I saw the Roberta guys do it in a few days. I saw BK Farm, Stacy Murphy. So all my folks who believe in, you know, helping folks early on, get on Kickstarter, donate money to Eric and Tyler. Thank you guys for coming on the show. Type and tell. We do this from time to time, folks. Listeners, thank you so much for listening to Hot Grease. You can join me Monday, every Monday at 3:30, right here on Heritage Radio Network. Until then, always take the road less traveled.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. Our near neighbors, our trading partners, Mexico and Canada, filed a suit recently with the World Trade Organization protesting the implementation of COOL, or country of origin labeling. I, for one, have kind of appreciated COOL because it tells me where my seafood comes from, and I don't always want to eat shrimp from Thailand. But in the World Trade Organization panel, they issued a preliminary ruling on the case that Canada and Mexico filed against the U.S., stating that the mandatory COOL requirements do not meet the United States' stated objective that the labeling law informs and helps U.S. consumers make purchasing decisions regarding the origin of their meat, produce, and other products covered by the labeling law. COOL started out as a voluntary labeling program in the Farm Security and Rural Investment Act of 2002, which was the Farm Bill then. It had specified that COOL would include pork, beef, lamb, fish, perishable agricultural products, and peanuts, and that it would become a mandatory requirement by September 30th, 2004. It actually was not implemented until 2009. I'm sure you've noticed, especially on your fish counter. However, opposition was mounted by numerous agricultural groups, including the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and the National Pork Producers Council, as well as from packers, processors, and retailers. COOL opponents argued that the program costs would far outweigh the benefits, which were not well determined, and that the marketplace and consumers should drive the need for such programs. Also, the consensus was that the effort driving COOL smacked of protectionism. Well, I can understand how they'd feel that way, because we buy so much young cattle from Mexico and Canada, and then it ends up being finished and processed here in the United States. And of course, we buy it very cheap from those countries, and then we can market up here. So the packers, processors, etc., make much more money than they would on cattle that they buy from the U.S. So anyway, long term, if the WTO ruling stands, the United States will have to dissolve mandatory COOL or risk trade retaliations from Mexico and Canada, both of whom are major U.S. trading partners. So it's something to ponder. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Check out a small clip from The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, a show where food and art intersect.
I think most recently you had a chocolate waterfall that had 5 tons of chocolate flowing, and you'd put on, what, a protective suit, walk through a waterfall, yeah, make your own chocolates within this kind of contained environment. And most recently, a rabbit cafe.
Yep.
Can you explain that one to me a little bit?
Well, I'm... And this also slightly comes from jellies as well, because in England, everyone has these rabbit jelly molds. It's the most popular mold. Everyone goes, oh, I had rabbit jellies as a kid. And we've always been utterly bewildered by it. Why rabbit jellies? The only way to get to the bottom of it was to get a whole herd of rabbits, open a cafe with them, and have people touch rabbits and eat.
Yeah.
So it kind of has resonance with one of our favourite cookbooks, which we think an awful lot of modern chefs have is their dark secret under their pillow, which is the futurist.
Want to hear more? Well, tune into The Food Scene live every week, Tuesdays at 3 p.m., or you can find all the archive shows on our website or subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening.